Welcome to another episode of the Wine Scholar Guild podcast. I'm Valerie Caruso, a French wine scholar and podcast host, and today I have the pleasure of introducing not only Decanter Magazine's Andrew Jefford, but sitting right next to me here in San Francisco is Christophe Tassin. You may remember Andrew from not only his writing, but also the Wine Scholar Guild webinars and past immersion trips. Christophe, who is currently the wine directory for the Battery here in San Francisco, will also be leading an upcoming trip, which we'll talk about later in the show. But welcome, gentlemen.
Welcome.
It's good to be with you again, Valerie.
Welcome, Andrew.
Good to be with you.
Before we get started, Christophe, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your relationship to the Rhone Valley?
My pleasure. I'm going to be very proud and very honored to do that with you. And thank you to all of you who will take the time to listen to us and be curious of the personality in the Rhone Valley. So I was born in 1962 in Avignon. I'm happy for the precision because, yes, for those who don't know where Avignon is located, Avignon is right on the south of the Rhone Valley. Being born at that time gives you an idea of when I started to get some interest in the wine. My family had a restaurant, so I was born in a dining room, and hospitality is what makes sense to me, and do something to make people happy or enjoy their time when they have an experience in a restaurant. And I did the restaurant school in Avignon in 1981. Andrew.
No, keep going. Tell us a bit more. Bring us up to date. What have you been doing in recent years?
It's important to give the detail, my opinion, because at that time in the 80s, we were not yet on the ratings of the wine, and the Rhone was doing his stuff. You know, you had plenty of. I had friends at my high school that were the kids of the wineries, of the winemakers, of the estates. So I grew up at the same time that the Rhone Valley grew up and came out of interest. And until then, the production was just to make the nicest wine as possible. But then. Starting to work in the dining room after the restaurant school, I honestly have no idea that I wanted to know about wine. It's what happened in the dining room that made me think of I must know better about wine, first because I'm a region of production, and then because the guest had questions about wine. Hey, why I should try this Châteauneuf-du-Pape instead of the Gigondas, which was the candy question, because honestly my family had a one-star Michelin restaurant, and at that time, if I had to suggest a wine from the Rhone Valley, people would give me the stinky eyes, you know, and say, well, I'm not coming to a restaurant to drink Rhone, you know, I want Bordeaux or Burgundy. So even in Avignon, the high-end wines were the Bordeaux and the Burgundy, the classics. So the for me, to feel that I could answer and deliver information that would have the clients at the restaurant enjoying more their wine was critical and very important. So this is the starting point of me understanding where I was standing after that, meaning that there were some competition starting with I did my military duty in 1985, the gigantic frost in the winter, and I learned many things about wine at that time. I had a little extra time to study about wine, and then I started my first competition. I needed to understand where I stand in the middle of the other profession. So other sommelier with competition being in Lyon, being in Paris, being in the Côte d'Azur, but there was not that many sommelier out of these places. I mean, not many restaurants could afford a sommelier in the dining room out of the highest level of the industry. So all of this competition drove me to gently, through the decades, try to as well achieve the highest of the sommelier reward, which was the MOF. Meilleur, which stands for Meilleur Ouvrier de France.
Tell us a little bit about what that means. Meilleur Ouvrier literally means best worker.
Yes, exactly.
How does that apply to wine and sommelierie?
best craftsman in its industry or in its job description. So the MOF, Meilleur Ouvrier de France, I'm gonna make an analogy with our dearest chef that passed away last week, Paul Bocuse. So Paul Bocuse was a MOF chef in 1960, probably at the same time I was just born. So this society exists since the late 20s. It covers over 100 different jobs, like caterer, like carpenter, sewing, I mean, designer for dress. It's masterizing anything that could be crafted by hand. The kitchen and the cook and the caterer being the most important of that society, some of the functions, some of the jobs of the restaurant industry were added later on, like sommelier, like maître d', to what the chefs and the cooks were achieving. So it's pretty recent that the sommelier were added. But what I would like to highlight on that, what is a MOF? So a MOF is a person that carries the legacy of the masterize of his job. Of course, MOF stands for Meilleur Ouvrier. Ouvrier is MOF has been put up to give an opportunity to an employee that could not at that time. Think about the 20s. I mean, you have to go back to work. You're 16. You're old. You go to get a job. You have to bring back money to the family. There is no way you're going to study for 7 or 8 more years to learn more about. So you learn on seat. You learn through your masters. You have to find a mentor that passed to you all of his knowledge. Then this diploma or this reward is given to the person that achieve, that knows how to pass that experience and legacy and achieve a master. It is a master because it's recognized by the education, by the l'éducation nationale. You can teach after that when you achieve the MOF even. So you are the top, part of the top of your industry, and you carry what has been built by your ancestors and you teach it to the next generation to come. So you pass away the knowledge of your work. This is the MOF.
Okay, so that's a kind of a craftsman aspect to it, like compagnonnage, as the French say, this tradition of craftsmen in every single respect of life. It's very impressive here, actually. I've always been super impressed by what I've discovered about these styles of competitions. So a huge congratulations for doing so well in that, Christophe. Fantastic
achievement. It took me 17 years, but it's fine. But the comparison is perfect. I mean, compagnonnage is what it's very similar to.
Yeah, trade guilds in the medieval sense, if you want to think about it like that, brought up to date. Well, we're very lucky to have you working with the Wine Scholar Guild and can take advantage of all that wonderful knowledge. Something you said when you were describing your route to where we are today was interested me. You said that, you know, when you began, the Rhone wines weren't taken at all seriously. If you went out to a restaurant and wanted to drink something serious, it had to be Bordeaux or Burgundy. When did that begin to change?
So the I mean, it's ironic to know that the Rhone Valley has been recognized as one of the first cultivated vineyard in Gaul. I mean, in France, at about 2,000 years ago, and not being part of all of this excitement and mapping system and recognition, and on top of it, it's in the Rhone Valley that the AOC system was born and put up in place. So all of these compared to other, if you compare to the history, it's just a matter of history for me. Bordeaux has been a center of interest because of the UK, the English people that were leading all of the ports and the industry. So then all of the families were in Bordeaux expediting wines, and Burgundy has the history of the monks in the middle age that were mapping the vineyard and putting on record and archives all of the experience of the places where the wine were getting the most of interest. So in the Rhone Valley, when I came out of the restaurant school, I went to taste with a courtier in Châteauneuf-du-Pape, and a courtier because at that time, a lot of people were still selling their wines in bulk, not doing bottles. And then I tasted in a glass that was almost like a mustard glass, you know. There was no stemware or nothing, and the point was to taste if the wine was healthy. That was it. and that was the stage. So you were doing wine by because your dad and your granddad was doing it, and luckily if you were able to sell it, you would survive. If not, it was just another thing that a family would do with other cultures. So that was the Rhone Valley at the time. What changed the perception of the Rhone, it's probably in the late 80s and early 90s, where the information started to spread out in a lot of easier ways, and honestly, of course, it's international communication that made that change. Making a cuvée, a head cuvée in Châteauneuf-du-Pape didn't exist before that time, but 1990, you had now, on 1989, you have Hommage Jacques Perrin, you have Da Capo from Pegau, and all of these wines were a way for these winemakers to stand in the middle of other wines and say, you know, the highest Burgundy sells for 300, the highest Bordeaux sells for 300, why there is no Rhone wine that sells for 300? And now you start to take out of your production the single example of the couple of barrels or the few of your old wines that give you the best of the wines, and you remove it from your blend, and now you put it in the middle of the other markets. So there have been an awareness to the wine consumer that there were amazing wines on the Rhone Valley spot.
Yeah.
All of this through the restaurant industry as well, with Fernand Point, La Pyramide, the restaurant in Paris that had the Côte Rôti, the restaurant in Monaco that same had the Grand Cru, the Châteauneuf-du-Pape, Nicolas. I've seen menus from Nicolas from the 50s that were having Châteauneuf-du-Pape on their list, and it starts from that point.
Okay. But really, the big change has been over the last 25 years. That's when the Rhone has come of age and joined those other fine regions. Well, let's bring it up to date a bit now and perhaps move on and talk about the Rhone as it is today, Christophe, if we can. And, you know, something that always comes to my mind when I think about the Rhone is, you know, is it really a single wine region? We used to thinking of it like that because that's the way that French bureaucracy presents it to us, presents these subregions to us. But in fact, when you look at the Northern Rhone and you consider the climate regime and the grape variety and the style of wine there, and then you compare it with the Southern Rhone, I often think they're two completely different regions that just happen to be joined by the same river. What's your opinion of that?
So I love that question because to me, wine defines and gives a picture of a location. You drink a wine and you close your eyes, and but luckily, if you visited that place before, you can go back to the place and revisit where you were or discover new places. But dramatizing in the meaning of say, I mean, we're missing one. The Vallée du Rhône is three spots. There is the one in Switzerland with the Petite Arvine and
true.
Where the
we mustn't
the
Rhone forget
River
about that
starts. But so it's just to I hope with this example answer a little bit of your question. So yes, the river is the link, but the Rhone Valley is really separated in two different things, historically and culturally, and even gastronomically. If you think about Lyon, the capital of gastronomy, that is the Northern Rhone with Vienne and the capital. I mean, these guys cook with butter, you know, and cream. And if you go to the south in Avignon and the Southern Rhone, I mean, we cook with the olive oil. It's a major difference. Though it's just 60 miles away, so overall it's a single. Of course, it can be presented, and it's more strength to show up as a group from a same region. But then again, the Northern Rhone is a single varietal in red. It's three varietals in white, but it's a completely different culture. It's a mother bedrock with granite or alluvial soils from the Rhone River. The south is a fennel spread with so many. It's a patchwork of different terroirs and climates, which explains the 23 different grapes that you overall can use to make the Rhone Valley wine. So they are really, really, really two different regions, but they must be understood together.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's focus on the Northern Rhone, if we can, first of all. One of the interesting things for me that's going on in the Northern Rhone at the moment is this sort of dichotomy between single vineyard wines, as they call Basselaire up there, and then the tradition of making Great Hermitage and so on, which is to blend different parts of the hillside. And you can see something of the same in many of the other appellations there as well, in Côte-Rôtie, in Condrieu to some extent too, and in Saint-Joseph. It's really a kind of tension between the Bordeaux way of doing things, which is to blend and make the best wine, however you can do that, and then the Burgundy way, which is always to respect the origin at its smallest possible potential, as it were. What's your view of this this little struggle? Do you think Passelaire, the single vineyards, are the ideal for Hermitage and Saint-Joseph and those other appellations, or will blends always win through in the end?
I really, really find out that question to be probably the most interesting on approaching the Rhone Valley vineyard, on the sense of what does the location mean? Is it the blending that matters, like it's a tradition in the south, to kind of wave a little bit the effects of the climates? But overall, the core of the wine production nowadays is trying to produce a wine that is not what your neighbors is doing. I mean, countrywide as well. Grenache from Santa Barbara, or Grenache from Napa Valley, or Grenache from Uruguay, as they all have different profiles. So going to that direction, I believe that it's very difficult and complicated to catch when it goes to the consumer. But all the system of the AVAs, appellations, DOC, DOCGs, and all of the system that were even built in the 15th century in Portugal to organize the production of the wine, goes the ultimate production is Burgundy. Because in within a village now, you have identification of the plots and the locations that gives the best result. That we want it or not, in Côte-Rôtie or in Hermitage, if you go to the hill of Hermitage, there is a specific spot of the hill that is not granitic. There is a specific spot of the hill that is with gravels as well, and with pebbles. So they will give three different results. And you can take the example of Clos Vougeot. I mean, there is now over almost 100 owners, and before it was only the monks that they were keeping the top of the hill for themselves and their own consumption, and then blending the middle and then blending with the bottom. Though I love the idea of the single vineyard identification in Côte-Rôtie, like you can find with the La Landon. I mean, there is a few examples with Gérin, Rostin, Gigal that does La Landon. It has a complete different expression of the Syrah than the other places, as Les Grandes Places or many other places. But the danger is making things too complicated, and who will be able to read these wines? So I think it's a must be. When I was at Rensselaer School, I could not understand the difference between Châteauneuf du Pape and Rasto. I said, why one is a cru and why one is not? It took me a little time to understand that it was the winemaker that didn't want too much of complication to produce. I mean, monitoring the yield, monitoring the soils, understanding what the things there were. The idea of a cru, an identification of a village, was making sense. Then plots in within the village make sense as well. I mean, Bordeaux is no different. I mean, of course, it's the art of blending different varietals, but they go by villages as well, with Saint-Estèphe, Margaux, Pauillac, and then in within the village, the spot. I mean, La Fleur Saint-Jean, the neighbor of Petrus, doesn't sell the same price as Petrus. It took a long time to identify that Petrus on that spot was the most magic for that blend of grapes. So the Rhône Valley, I think, goes gently the way of this parcellar identification that I think through the time will make more sense on just the growing of the system of the appellation contrôlée. Some time and for some climatic reasons, like in the south, yes, the blending component is part of the identity of the place.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree with that. It's very, very easy, I think, to see the Northern Rhône as a Burgundy-like zone of fascinating tiny things. It does really change when you get down to the south. Suddenly you have a very different landscape. You have much, much larger area. I mean, Châteauneuf-du-Pape, I think, is 24 times the size of Hermitage. There's a lot more raw material
largest,
to play with.
Right, I often say that the largest estate of Châteauneuf-du-Pape is bigger than the appellation Condrieu itself. So, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Now, before we leave the Northern Rhône, just give us a tip or two. What's the best value up there at the moment, as far as you're concerned?
Ah, that's nice. To finish the idea of the what we were just talking about, it's interesting to currently look at Champagne. So. And mostly from outside eyes. So Peter Liam just finished a book about Champagne, and he is noticing that Champagne is switching now on having single vineyards coming out. There is over 31 clos in Champagne, so we all tend to specify where the wine comes from. And sorry to take that example on the industry, but 30 years ago you had the yogurts, your play with the apricot, you know, flavored. And now it's apricot coming from Provence. Now it's apricot coming from that farm. So we all want specifications of what we are enjoying as edible food and obviously with the wine. So going back to the North Rhône and your question about what are the values now, you may be aware that it's the right bank on the Rhône that is the most largest area of production, but Hermitage and Croze. So I would highly recommend you to keep an eye on all of the effort of now of this young generation of winemakers that are trying to revive the Vignoble de Vienne. So Sessuel and the Vignoble de Vienne is still growing vines. They're putting back the vineyards on the terrace, which are the granitic, the perfect counterpart of Cotterotti on the other side. And they cannot sell at the same price as Cotterotti because they don't have the experience and don't have the backup for that. So you have on that spot equivalent wines that are way below their price point and the quality, because they need to integrate the market and to be understood. So that's one. Probably the best value are now some of the Vin de Pays, or what was the Vin de Pays, sorry, it's now IGP or it's now Vin de France, that were the Collines Rhodaniennes. And you have Viognier, Vin de Pays or Vin de France, Viognier that are vineyards not planted most often planted on the top of the hillside and the mountain, more like on organic soils. You have delightful wines that are just affordable for everybody at just not even 10 euros. I believe these wines are outstanding values.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and in particular, look out for those IGP names, because the wines you mentioned from Vienne, the Vin de Vienne, they also go to market at this stage as IGP. They don't yet have an appellation, so that's a really great tip, Christophe. And what about down in the south? What should we look out for down there?
So, values of the south I must insist a little bit on the complete different profile of production in the south. The vineyards were planted on the worst soils, on the meaning of you had to keep the best soils for productions of cereals, of fruit and orchards, and it's like that on many places along the river itself, and like Châteauneuf-du-Pape, the vines were planted where the pebble stones, you could not plant anything else than vines, and it comes out that I have an amazing story for you about that. One of the winemaker, my best friend that introduced me to understand the terroir of Châteauneuf-du-Pape, told me that his dad, when his dad purchased a parcel in La Croix on top of there, the person that sold that parcel told him, I cannot ask you money for a piece of land that only have stones. And the guy said, I must give you a little bit of money, because if not, the clerk won't do the transaction. So they did it for almost nothing, which is nowadays the most expensive part of Châteauneuf-du-Pape. But they didn't know these pieces of land with all of these gigantic pebbles were ruining all of the tools to work the soil, were ruining the animals and the horses to cultivate the soil. So nobody wanted them. It's insane. Now the top production place of Châteauneuf-du-Pape, nobody wanted it at the time, of everything was made by hand, and it's now, I would say, one of the component. I mean, it's very difficult to have a single Grenache on a single spot. You must have a blending component to just again polish a little bit the excess of the Mistral, of the wind. So the blending is a safety measure on the Southern Rhone, and so the best values are to me on the vineyards. Like I'm going to take the example of a Plan de Dieu that just became one of the village. Its own now. Name of appellation, because you can find again, when I say value, is a wine that delivers emotion or create emotions to you without you spending a zillion or a ton of money, because everybody wants it from such a too small of a place. So that is to me the top value, and you can find signature Grenache even in Signargues on the right side of the Rhone Valley when you go away from Avignon to Nîmes. This area has the same pebbles and Châteauneuf-du-Pape, the same clay below, and does magic wines, and they are unknown, and there the Southern Rhone will always give you an unknown place to find the gem that you're looking for, the beautiful Grenache that can stand aging, and things like Gadagne, another example of pebbles and soil. So yes, so Rhone, you have
very happy hunting ground down in the south. That's fantastic. You mentioned Gadagne. I visited that about this time last year, and it's true. When you look around, you might well be standing in the Gros Plateau of Châteauneuf. It looks exactly the same. Amazing potential quality there. Now, let's ask you to put your sommelier hat on for a moment and just tell us how the Rhone's white wines fit into the gastronomic universe. What's the point of them in the mealtime context? When would you recommend a white wine from the Rhone rather than a white wine from Burgundy or from Pessac-Léognan or from California somewhere? What do they do in a meal context?
Right, so white wine in the Rhone is a step you must try as well to understand. I mean, on the consumer side, on the sommelier side, because it is what I would call an anomaly, on the sense of why do white varietals were planted in older days? What was the function of the white varietals? And if you watch the varietals that were planted at that time, like the Claret, the Bourboulenc, the Picpoul, all of these varietals are late ripening grapes. So their purpose were to be harvested at the same time than the red, and bring the acidic component that were not available technically in the 40s, in the 50s, or even after Pasteur on the late 19th century. There was not malic acid that you could add just like with a few splashes of spoons on your winemaking thing. So there were natural experience from the winemakers to balance their wine, and again, going against the heat and the Mistral and the dryness and not having wines overpowered by alcohol, they had the intelligence to spread, when there were plenty in vineyards, these white varietals in the middle of the red. And you have randomly planted white in the middle of the red. So which, when the appellation system was created, which had an obligation to not cut off this tradition to the white of the Rhone. So there is only Cornas, to my knowledge, on the north that cannot add any of the white, but any single, all of the single other appellations still have the authorization of practice to ferment, co-ferment the white. You, obviously, you do not blend white wine and red wine after, but you have to co-ferment the white through the red. But now, in the 90s, with the technology and the stainless steel tanks, the control of temperatures in the new cellars, they did not need anymore this acidic balance from the white grape. So they started to treat and to harvest the white separately, because in the same way, on masterizing and monitoring the cold temperature of the fermentation, they were able to get wines that were fresh, and the Viognier is the top example. Almost the grapes almost disappeared from Condrieu after World War II. There were only a couple of acres, because they wanted it, and it was almost always slightly sweet and residual sugar. But on the south, I think since these new technologies were implemented in cellars, you have delightful wines, delightful whites. The Grenache white came out, but again, it's barely by itself. You always have a mix of Clairette, Roussanne, Marsanne, often some Viognier in the south that to bring some fruit. But these are wines that lots of sommeliers love to use, because they are on a different, how can I say, the profile compared to the Chardonnay and the complexity and the oak aging. It's different than Bordeaux, because the Sauvignon and Semillon blend is a little more citrusy and a little more acidic. So you have now another category of white that is food friendly, on the sense of it's, yes, it's probably a richer, more milder style of a blend, but the flavor profile is amazing. And I'm sorry to add that factor to it, but the price point, the white wine being a higher price point, makes it more interesting for the restaurant industry, because you're going to have a little higher markup. You're going to have a little more a possibility to with something that is not yet known by the consumer, approach with a wine that is of interest on the flavor profile, that can match the gastronomy easily. And on top of it, you're making money. The story is, when I started, I had a lovely Viognier from the village of Saint-Gervais, from the Domaine Sainte-Anne in the 80s. And I was asking my friend that worked in Monaco, why don't you have this wine on your menu? I mean, it's lovely with all of these vegetables from Mediterranean, all this fish from the area. And he said, not enough expensive. That's too affordable.
That's the kind of thing we like to hear. So we'll definitely hang on to that. And it's true, I can support very much what you say about the gastronomic subtlety of these wines. They do work terrifically well with food. They don't have the same kind of bells and whistles and handles that some other white wines have, but they're all the better for that in the mealtime context. And I guess we should also say that, you know, with the increasing popularity of Mediterranean-style food in general, these wines have a bigger and bigger place, I think, at mealtimes and in restaurants. Now, something I can't fail to ask you when we talk about the Rhone is your position on the great alcohol question. Obviously, in Châteauneuf, you'll very often be uncorking red wine, even white wine, at 14.5, 15. Is that too strong, or can you drink wines at that kind of strength with pleasure and find them balanced and fresh and enticing?
So that's a very nowadays question. Everybody is concerned about that. It's tied to the. I mean, is there a global warming or not? What is the consumption about? And I'm here in San Francisco. When I do my job of sommelier, I see that concern every day. That people We experimented this factor in the Languedoc when the most powerful wines were made, and after one glass, I mean, you say, I cannot finish the bottle. It's too big of a wine. So I have two answers almost for that. Sometimes a wine is at 14% of alcohol and you can't feel it because you have a good balance to it. You have the right amount of tannins. You have a very good acidic components, pH to it. And it's a part of the balance. But then, yes, I see wines now, and I've seen that a few times in Henri Bonneau's cellar in Châteauneuf-du-Pape. I mean, he did a special bottling even with that in 1998, 1999. So it's 16.8. I mean, it's almost at the level of port wine, but it becomes something different than regular wine. So what are we doing with this? It's a concern. Today, probably, I'm going to take the example of California. Why did we have in the 1980s Robert Mondavi Reserve Cabernet at 12.5, and why is it nowadays at least 16? It's ridiculous. So I discussed with Tim himself, and he told me, in the 80s, I mean, you know that before the phylloxera crisis, the vines were struggling, so we could not achieve even a higher alcohol or higher sugar content in the fruit because it did not exist. The vines were regulating themselves, but because they were struggling to grow. And then when we replanted everything after the phylloxera, any single plant of vine is a champion, produce the best fruit ever, and now you're going to end up with a wine that is at least at 15.8 or 15.5. I think what saves the Rhone Valley yet from that format of danger is we are nursing our own Massal selection. It's still a diverse replanting way. It's all the matter of a cultural practice, this level of alcohol. So we must be conscious of it and try to keep the blending and the diversity of mixing grapes. If you do single Grenache, you're done. It's going to be difficult to have a ripe Grenache below 14. So, but mixing it with a little bit of Syrah, with a little bit of Cinsault, with a little bit of Carignan, why not? A little bit of Cunoise. I'm sure there is many of the grapes that could allow to maintain a level of alcohol that is still decent to enjoy the food, to not overpower the consumption of the wine.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think we always have to bear in mind that the balance is possible at any level of alcohol. It all depends on the other components in the wine. And what I always say to people is, taste the wine first, have a sip or two, drink a glass before you decide that it's got too much or too little alcohol. Try not to look at the figure on the label the whole time and decide before you even taste it. Now, two very quick questions to finish, if we can, Christophe. First of all, we love you so much, we're going to write you a big check so you can buy a vineyard somewhere to make a Domaine Tasson wine. Where are you going to do it? Where are you going to buy? Somewhere in the road,
man.
Of course.
So the first, without thinking, the first answer would be, yeah, Châteauneuf-du-Pape, because it's the magic place with an amazing outcome on an identity that that comes out from the wine that is not reproducible anywhere else. So that's the dream place. And it's funny because when you say, yeah, how do you guys sommelier recognize a wine in a blind? You know, are you special? No, I mean, when a sommelier recognize a wine in a blind, it's not the sommelier is good. It's the wine that is good. It's the wine that has a specific character that you cannot find anywhere else. So, yes, my answer would be Châteauneuf-du-Pape. Though, but if I think a little bit about it, I own a piece of land in Nyons, which is the eastern extreme, even eastern than Vinsobre, or Gigondas. So thinking of the conversation we had on ways to manage the heat or global warming maybe coming, or a different way to cultivate wines, there are probably places on the hillside of mountains, like Vinsobres is the coolest area. Gigondas is different than Châteauneuf-du-Pape because it's a colder climate down to this Dentelle de Montmirail. And you have now a way to keep tannins and to keep freshness to the blending of the wine. And Gigondas is probably the appellation to look out now, you know it.
Okay, well, we'll hang on to those names in case any of us come into a fortune in the interim. Now, final question. We intend to ask all of our guests on the Wine Scholar Guild podcast this question right at the end, and it's a more personal one. It's about you particularly, yourself, and it's if you were a wine, Christophe, which wine would you be and why?
Yeah, I love to be a wine because I'm going to give some emotion and pleasure, you know, so it makes me happy to think about this way. Never thought about how I could be a wine. And sommelier, I mean, how does this job exist? It's unbelievable. Having a job on being the link on between a producer and a consumer. So I find that fascinating and I love it. I mean, having a whole career about wine is the friendliest thing I ever done, and connecting with people. It's the most social, interesting life and excited life. So if I had to be a wine, which wine would I be? My dad was Italian born. My granddad was a Mason. He came in France after World War II, and got to this location of Lyon. So he built his own house, and not to be a burden for the neighbors, with the house that was outside of the town, they built their own little farm. Meaning that they had coops, I mean chickens, they had rabbits, and because they were Italians. You see people here in Philadelphia or in the East Coast, they purchase grape and they do wine in their bathtub or in their basement. So he planted 10 rows of vines at the house that still exist. My dad did make the wine from these vines. I still do making the wines from these vines. So this is the wine I would like to be. But the vintage to come, 18, because it's the miracle of nature is going to happen again, and it's more promises, and of course it's tied to the place I was born, it's tied to my family, and it's all the added value to the wine that I want to be.
That's a lovely answer, thank you. And Valerie,
that's great.
Thank you.
Yes, Andrew, I'm back. I'm just sitting here listening to you too, and boy, I'm learning a lot. That was a great question, and I think the only thing we want to know before we wrap this up, Christophe, is as far as the tour, where can we learn more about it? What can we expect? What do we have to look forward to on this trip?
The tour is going to be your way to approach all of this diversity, and certainly an easier way to understand the Rhone Valley than what you can catch on books. The smelling, feeling, touching, wandering around all of these pieces of land and really experiencing the connection in between the food and all of what is produced on site with the wines that comes from the place is pretty stunning. So I invite you to join, and specifically again to help all of your feelings and emotions tied to the real spot. It's always better to understand wine when you see where it comes from.
That is so true. And listeners, again, you can find out more information about this upcoming immersion trip and other French wine information on the website at wineschollerguild.org. Andrew, Christophe, this was such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining
me
today.
Thank you, Arnaud. Thank you, Valerie.
And my pleasure, too. Great to chat with you again, Valerie. And Christophe, have a great trip.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.